wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again on truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letter u.org. I'm Jono. Joining me from Ireland is Sir Jason of spiritualbabies.net. G'day, mate.
Good morning.
Wonderful to have you back. And in Jakarta, Indonesia, is the author of the recently released Let's Get Biblical, Why Doesn't Judaism Accept the Christian Messiah? Volume 1 and 2, essential reading for all listeners of Truth to You. You can get it from his website, outreachjudaism.org, outreachjudaism.org. Welcome back to the program, Rabbi Tobias Singer.
Hey, it's great to be here. And just to explain, I know many listeners are wondering, what the heck am I doing in Jakarta? And the truth is, it's hard for me to hang around the Gentiles. So therefore, I need to be in a place where there's only Jews. So I came to Jakarta. But as I acclimate myself to Gentiles, because I found there was a Gentile in Jakarta, I had to look all over. So then I'm slowly acclimating myself to Gentiles, and then I'll be ready for a place
There's only 83 Jews in Indonesia. I thought that's what you told me.
And they're all hiding. Anyway, so they're all hiding on the chairs, on the toilets. They're scared to move. No, I'm not ready. I'll tell you, I grew up in Brooklyn, and I could either be in Brooklyn, but I can't stand the trains screeching on the overhead. So I figured, where else can I go? A place that looks like that has some... that sounds, looks like Brooklyn, and Jakarta was the closest thing. So I decided I had no choice. So Jakarta, that's it.
I've got a question about that.
Yes, go ahead.
So we've just entered, in the southern hemisphere, we've just entered spring.
Yes.
In the northern hemisphere, you've entered. Now, Jason, is it autumn or in Ireland, do you call it fall?
We call it autumn, which is what it should be called. It is
that's
autumn.
That's the Queen's English, right? That's what we call it as well. But in Brooklyn, they call it fall. Now, I assume, of course, this is because all the leaves fall off the trees. But in Indonesia, I'm just thinking, like, it's so close to the equator. Does it matter if it's spring or if it's autumn or if it's fall? I mean, I just assume that the trees are so confused that they do everything at once, and the flowers are coming out and it's fruiting and the leaves are falling off. And what's going on there in Indonesia?
I know this will come as a shock to many of the listeners, so I just sort of pay you that I'm not sure exactly which side of the equator I'm on, because I wasn't prepared for this conversation. So if you don't mind, I want to take out a minute and flush the toilet and see which way the water goes down. So I'll be back in 1 minute. And then I'll look at the water and I'll see which way it's going down. I'll know which side of the equator, because I don't know which side it's on.
I think you're with me in the southern hemisphere at the moment.
I don't know which side I'm on. That's what I'm saying. Give me a moment. Let me flush the toilet. Let me find out. Then I'll tell you.
Because
that's what we do.
You have to go do that now. Go do it.
See, most people, when they want to know where they are, they take out a GPS system and take out a coordinates. In Indonesia, what you do is they flush the toilet and say, aha, this is where I am. And that's what they use, the GPS system. Some people, I know it's hard to believe, but some people, when they're driving, they don't need GPSs. Androids cost a fortune. So what they do instead is they have a portable toilet in their car and they flush the toilet and they know exactly where they're located. So that's what we do here. The GPS is really a toilet.
Equator.
Yeah, they don't know. You're across the car. Aha, give a look. Give one more flush. Aha, make a left turn. A flush again, make a right turn. So that's, just so you know, no, there's no reason to throw away money in the garbage for some Samsung Note 3, Note 4, with some Android kind of garbage like this. All you have to do is carry a toilet and flush it in the car, and that's the end of it. The only, of course, the downside is that you lose the passenger seat for a toilet instead. But aside from that, it's a completely reliable system.
There's no reason why you can't sit on the passenger.
No, of course not.
Usable and it's got benefits.
The only thing is they don't know which way to drive over here. So here in Jakarta, which are idiots, they drive on the wrong side. That means they're on, I don't know what goes on in Australia, but they actually drive on the...
Thank you very much. I'm not sure about Indonesia, but here we drive on the correct side, whereas in the States, you guys drive on the wrong side of the road.
Yep. God, don't tell me.
Jason, help me out here. Come on.
We drive on the right side.
We drive on the right. Do you mean the correct side or the left or the right side?
I mean the correct side. The same side as you.
Damn straight.
Do you know how scary it is? Let me explain to you. I mean, it's hard to tell from my British accent where I'm from, but the whole life, you know, a driver is sitting on the left side, properly, the way God intended it. So what happens is that...
It's written.
Well,
you got a verse for that, right?
Well, yeah, this is everybody knows this. So what happens... We'll do next. By the way, I just want to announce to the listeners that I was the one playing the guitar in the middle of the beginning of the show. That's me, by the way, playing the guitar. So you want to know who's playing that nice guitar? It's me. I'm playing everything. But what happens is that when you come from the United States, from New York, the center of the universe, where the Torah was given. So what happens is that you go to a place where they drive on the completely wrong side, the blasphemy side, on the
side of Satan.
I don't mean this in a bad way when I say the side of the devil. I don't mean that disparagingly, but please take it in the vein that I intended it. So what happens?
What is that in the background? Is that you flushing the toilet?
I know. By the way, I am in the northern hemisphere, just so you know. I just determined that. You're paying, I don't know what, for your cell phone. I don't need any of this stuff. I'm saving a fortune. I'm flushing toilets. I know exactly where I'm standing. I am in the northern hemisphere.
I'm pretty sure you're kind of slightly in the southern hemisphere, aren't you?
It's enough about you. Let's talk about
I think your toilet's broken.
Listen to me, gorgeous person.
Your toilet's broken.
So what happens is, do you know how scary it is to a New Yorker who walks in the street and sees a car going by and there's no one in the driver's seat?
That happens often. What do you mean?
There's no one sitting on the left side. They're all sitting.
But somebody's sitting on the GPS there, right?
Oh,
someone's sitting on the other side. So it's very scary. So you have to understand what's going on when you walk the street. I have to prepare all the listeners because they're all coming to Indonesia soon. That what you see when you see a car riding, just to prepare you, what you see is you see where a driver should be, there's a toilet, and on the other side is a person who's sitting there, a passenger, except he has a wheel in front of him. The toilet's there for directions, and the wheel is there for something, because the British once came here, and they, you know, and so on. So that's it. Anyway, so this is a very spiritually uplifting show.
That's the situation. But what you didn't answer my question. What I want to know is, at this time of the year, what is going on with the trees in Indonesia? I mean, like I said, are the leaves falling off? All is right, there fruit right. coming out? Well, are the flowers coming out?
Let me hold your hand, sweetheart. Walk you through this whole thing. Okay. There are two seasons in Indonesia, okay? There's the hot season and the very hot season. There's no seasons here. It gets light at 6 o'clock and it gets dark at 6 o'clock, period. That's the end of it. Because there yes.
Okay, so wait a minute. So here in Australia, here where I am on the farm in New South Wales, all the fruit trees are blossoming and the wattle's out and it's beautiful and it's great. Jason, where you are, I'm assuming, you know, leaves are falling off the trees, right?
Oh, yeah, temperature's dropping, the leaves are falling off the trees, the sky is now a charcoal grey, it's beautiful.
That's what's going on, but in Indonesia, it's just hot, and I just assume that the trees are confused, and they're just doing everything at once.
Yeah, the truth is, in Ireland, they really don't know. They're too drunk to know what season it is. But in truth, over here, Indonesia happens to be a very, because the whole country, it's a big country, but the whole country is built, a lot of it, on volcanic ash and so on, because there's volcanoes everywhere you go, and you're bumping into a volcano. So therefore, the earth is extremely fertile here. Everything is growing here. Wherever it's growing, it's flying. Everything grows over here, all over the place, all the time. There's no seasons over here. Nothing.
So listen, well, speaking of volcanoes, have you experienced any tremors while you've been there?
There was a couple of days ago. There was some sort of tremor, but as it turns out, I was sleeping, so I missed the whole experience.
Okay. So listen, it's this time of year as well, Jason. I'm sure you can relate, and it must be like this in New York, I assume. But it is this time of the year when people start to creep in, you know, the shops begin to creep in some Christmassy sort of decorations and some promos begin, and then there's some advertising on TV. That's around this time of year is when they like to get in early and start doing the Christmas stuff. And I thought, this is a good opportunity so that we don't, you know, you don't want to leave it too late and you know, burst people's bubbles right before Christmas. That's no fun. They've got everyone coming around. They're coming around for lunch. The family is coming, and all of a sudden, you know, we've popped people's bubbles. I thought now is a good time. Now we can look at the Christmas narrative and maybe, you know, a few other passages and try and put some things together and make sense of it all. Now's the time to do it. What do you reckon?
Yeah, absolutely, yep. Tis the season.
Tis almost, we're approaching the season to be jolly, and if we can do something about that now and we get in early, I think it's a good idea. And what I thought we would do, Tobia, is begin... If I may, I thought I might read in my, maybe I'll use my, I always feel like when I'm reading from the narrative of the, you know, the birth of Jesus, I want to use my, my Anglican priest voice, and I'm going to read from, what?
That an Anglican priest voice is usually a kind of clipped Kermit the Frog voice with a clothespin on his nose.
I'm starting from Matthew chapter, Matthew chapter 2. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, the wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And when he had gathered all the chief priests and the scribes of the people together, he inquired of them, "Where is the Christ to be born?" And so they said unto him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for it is written by the prophet."
By the way, you should know that the ancient scribes scribes and Pharisees, they all spoke with an Anglican accent. We all know that. I mean, it happens to be. No, that's a fact that they use the King James Bible in the days of Herod.
That's right. Yeah. And this is the quote from the prophet. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judea, are not the least among the rulers of Judea, for out of you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people. And I've got a little asterisk there. If I go down, it tells me that that comes from Micah chapter 5, verse 2. Now, before we even talk about that, I just have a quick question. I don't want to get carried away on this topic, but where it says, Tobia, that the wise men followed a star. I don't know if anyone's ever thought about this before. Jason, maybe you've thought about it before. If you were in the next town, there's a town called Canoundra near where I am, and it's about a half-hour drive. You're there, and you're approaching my place here in Cowra, and you say, "Where are you?" "I'm on my way. I'm driving." And I say to you, "Well, look up in the sky. Can you see that aeroplane?" And you say, "Oh, yeah, I can see an aeroplane. You know, it's dark, and I can see it blinking in the distance." And I said, "Okay, it's over my house now." That's where I am. Right? Do you think, just based on that information, you'd be able to pinpoint where it is? And now, this is a star we're talking about, Tobia. It's a star. I mean, how many billions of kilometers is it? Light years away. Yeah. How can anyone follow a star, let alone an aeroplane, to pinpoint a house on the ground? Is there another understanding to this that you're aware of?
No. But let me just make a point here. It's even more interesting because these people from the east, ostensibly these are some from maybe from Assyria. These are Gentile people who are following a star. So the star is also moving slow enough for them to follow the star. And the star is guiding them, and it stops over, you know, Herod's palace in Jerusalem.
This is a low flying star. This thing
is Matthew hasn't. This actually, even though this seems funny, what I'm going to do is I'm going to defend the Matthew point here in a strange way. That means Matthew clearly, and you'll see in a moment why this is actually very significant. Matthew clearly has in mind a magical star with a GPS system that could find, that first of all could be followed by someone, by a group of goyim from the east who are coming to Jerusalem, and it could stop eventually over the house of Jesus. So this is a very special star that can hover, that could move and move slowly enough so that people could follow it and then move on, and it knows exactly where it's going. And And of course, if you looked and if you were standing, I mean, imagine, I sometimes tell students, go out into the at night on a starry night and look up at the sky and ask yourself, which house is that star over? Of course, it'll be a little silly. But what, and there's a point here, and you're going to see how all this is going to make a lot of sense. And it's going to, in fact, going to be an ominous point. But Matthew has in mind what he's bringing into view is that this is not any ordinary star, but this is a magical star that knows exactly what it's doing, and it knows exactly how to find addresses, even if it doesn't know the addresses, you'll see in a moment, and it could be followed, it could stop, it could start, it could continue, and it could be followed, and it could be identified which house is over. This is going to be very important later on in this interview. That's going to be unbelievable.
Right. Because you are both wrong. You're both wrong.
Jason.
Sorry. It was a UFO. That's all I'm going
to say. I was going to say, if it resembles anything, it has to be a UFO, right?
John St. Knowles as a lizard in a UFO. I've seen it on the internet.
This is in Ireland. This is all the time, by the way, for those of you listening to the show. This is
we follow lights around streets at nighttime all the time.
So what you're telling me is we're going to come back to that. Okay, that's because I've always been curious about that. But it does go on to say that in Bethlehem of Judea, for it is written by the prophet, but you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judea, are not the least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. That apparently is Micah 5:2. Yeah. Now, where do we? I want to get to Micah chapter 5 because I'd love for you to put this passage in its context and tell us what exactly is it saying. Before we get there, do you want to just explain a little bit more about the birth of Jesus? This narrative. I mean, it's here in Matthew. It's also found in Luke, right?
Right. There are 20, for those of you who, most of you are Christians who are not familiar with this, the infancy narrative, I'm kidding, is only found in two books of the New Testament. It's found only in Matthew, Luke, Mark. Apparently, Mark found there was nothing unusual about Jesus' birth, about anything unusual about the city he was born in. None of that is mentioned in the book of Mark. And the city of Bethlehem, John never says that Jesus was born in the city of Bethlehem, although in John 7, someone asks, isn't he supposed to be born in Bethlehem? But John does nothing in to contradict that or to set the record straight at all. So the infancy narrative is only found in two books, in Matthew and in Luke. And as we would expect, we don't know who wrote Matthew. We don't know where the book of Matthew was written, but we do know something. And that is that whoever Matthew was, we call Matthew, whoever that was, he was writing for a Jewish audience. He had a Jewish audience in mind. And therefore, whereas Luke will simply tell a story, let's say, tell a story of the birth of Jesus, what a virgin, he will not appeal to a verse from the Jewish scriptures to demonstrate, to prove that this is what the Messiah is supposed to do or anything like that. Matthew is writing with a Jewish audience in mind, and therefore Matthew is going to say this is not an arbitrary event, but this is a fulfillment of what was prophesied in the Jewish scriptures. Matthew will do this 11 times in his gospel. Mm-hmm. Scholars refer to this as fulfillment citations. This is one of the 11. One of the strange things, not strange, but ironically, although whoever wrote Matthew, we can be sure that his intent was that he wanted Jews to accept the teachings, to embrace Christianity, that it could easily be argued that there was no human being in history that was more responsible for the rejection of Christianity than Matthew, than whoever wrote Matthew. Because if Matthew had not altered and tampered with the Jewish scriptures, had not changed the text, and we'll see in a moment how serious what adventure he went on. We'll see exactly what he's done in this text, and many of you know other texts. Many, many Jews, no doubt, would have in fact embraced Christianity. So it's sort of v'nehapechu. It's like the story in the book of Esther, that Haman sought to hang the Jews on the gallows, and ultimately Haman was hanged on it. Although Matthew sought to convert Jews to Christianity by appealing to these passages, in fact, it would be this kind of slipshod quoting that would force Jews who might have embraced Christianity, who might have found some of its messages to be emotionally appealing, but this made it impossible because he had misquoted the Jewish scriptures. One of the things I think that just should be pointed out as you approach this point, because it just connects in. There's an ominous point of this story, so we're just going to provide a context here, if it's okay, because just so we don't move around a little bit. The reason, I just want to make sure that the listeners understand the story, because you, the listener, should be asking a question. Again, the story, as John just pointed out, is people from the East, these whatever astronomers from the East, they're following the star. It's moving slowly enough. It comes to Herod's palace. It means it comes to Jerusalem, okay, and it stops. These non-Jews go in, and they inquire, where is the Messiah supposed to be born? Herod is an Edomite. He doesn't Evesnish. He doesn't know. So Ephraim, he asks, we all know that Herod spoke fluent Yiddish, so he asked, the rabbis, the priests, he asked them, where is the Messiah supposed to be born? They say he's supposed to be born in Bethlehem, and supposedly, we're told, they quote this verse from Michael, which we're going to look at in a moment. Then the wise men go, essentially, aha, oh, okay, good. And then the star takes off, and now instead of hovering over Herod's palace, now begins to move again. Now, remember, nowhere do they say on what street. It doesn't say the Messiah is born in Bethlehem on 41st Street between 5th and 6th Avenue. It doesn't say that. All it says is born in Bethlehem. But this star, this is very important, now moves. They follow the star, and it hovers directly over the house that Jesus was born in. This raises every person listening to the story. This is why this magical star is important. This raises a monumental question. What's the obvious question? The story itself, it seems to have a piece that doesn't make sense. What is that part? What is vestigial? What it was unnecessary insertion in the story? If the star was smart enough to know how to find the exact address in Bethlehem where Jesus was born and where Jesus' home was, because remember, unlike Luke, Jesus' original home was in Bethlehem. There's no barn, there's no manger, there's no inn in Matthew, because it's very different. We'll get into that perhaps later. So the star knows exactly where the Messiah's home is. The question then is, why did Matthew insert the story of the star stopping off in Jerusalem to ask this question? If the star knew so much, if it's such a smart, that's what Matthew had in mind, as I mentioned earlier, the star should have taken these men from the East directly to Jesus' home in Bethlehem, because the star knows the house. Do you understand? Why?
I've never considered that before.
I know. I just got to the point I thought, why didn't the star just pop into the sky over the house? Why travel at all?
That means never, ever have I stopped to think about that, ever.
Why did he have to go? Do you understand? There's an imperative. There's a question. There's a thundering question there. And you have them. This is so critical. It's so important. This is also, my friends, this is ominous here. That means, I hope every one of you understands this. The star, I wasn't kidding around when I said, Matthew has in mind a magical star. I don't want to say, okay, it's funny, how could it be a star? That's not really where I wanted to go. Matthew has in mind a star that could stop and go and move slow enough and knows exactly where Jesus' home is, which was not information conveyed by Herod the Great and his scribes and rabbis. So Matthew could have written the story that the star goes straight to Bethlehem. Why did he have to stop off in Jerusalem?
I've got an answer.
Go ahead.
I know what the answer is. So the answer is, the star has to allow for the men of the East to tip off Herod so that Herod seeks to kill the child, so that the child and his family has to go to Egypt, so that when they come out of Egypt, it is fulfilled by the prophet. Yes, it is fulfilled by the prophet that out of Egypt I've called my son. Done. Magic Star, thank you very much. Without that, without Magic Star, we would never have fulfilled that particular prophecy, Tobia.
This is so intelligent, I don't even know what the heck you're talking about. Anyway, so...
Come on! I mean, that leads us into an entirely different program, doesn't it, bud?
I want to share this with you, and this is very serious and very sad. And this, of course, explains why Europeans who are Christians, who were influenced by Christian thinking and so on, this is a setup that has unfortunately poisoned and polluted the hearts of Christians for 2,000 years. Luther would have never been an anti-Semite had he not seen stories like this in the Gospels. Here's this is very interesting. Notice that there are two groups of people who discover that the King of the Jews, the Messiah, is to be born in Bethlehem. One is a group of Gentiles, and they are the people from the East. They come to the home of Jesus, where Jesus is born, and what do? Well, Matthew says that they worshipped him. They brought gifts, right? Very simple. And then they left. So that's what the Gentiles do when they encounter Jesus. What do the Jews do when they encounter Jesus? Not only one would think, aha, these rabbis, and Herod is the king of the Jews, he's the leader of the Jews. They discovered that the Messiah is born in Bethlehem. And what does Herod seek to do? He seeks to kill the child. This theme that Gentiles are looking to worship Jesus and the Jews are trying to kill an innocent baby is a story that will follow throughout the book of Matthew, and we will have a very similar stage later on at the passion narrative instead of the infancy narrative, a story that was told, and the result of this story is the death of untold millions of Jewish people. And that is, we have later on a very similar event, a setup where you have Pontius Pilate, and in fact in the book of Matthew, the only place where Pontius Pilate's wife is introduced as well. And Pontius Pilate and his wife, when Jesus they're asking, who should we let go? Who should we free? And the crowds are screaming, you know, crucify Jesus, and we take it upon ourselves and our children. Pontius Pilate and his wife are saying, this man is completely innocent. And Pontius Pilate wants nothing to do with it. His wife is saying, this man's in, she had a terrible dream. So what the setup here is very, very dark. The setup is that when the Messiah comes to be known and where he is, the Jews want to kill him, and the Gentiles want to worship him. And that's what's very dark here. This is not so funny.
Isn't that it? You're right. That is very, very clear. And what did become apparent to me only now when I was reading it in verse 3 of chapter 2 in Matthew, it says, when Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. All Jerusalem was troubled? Yes,
that's right. I mean, why were you troubled? Mashiach is born. Go think. These rabbis, all of them knew. They're troubled. But look at the wise men. The wise men are going there, and there's nothing to be said bad about them. But they're goyim. They're non-Jews, and therefore they're going there to venerate him, to worship him. And the Jews are troubled, and ultimately the leader of the Jews will go to kill Jesus. And of course, Joseph is going to have to flee to Egypt in order to escape the wrath of Herod and remains there. And of course, you have another one of these 11 fulfillment citations, which is outrageous, where he quotes Hosea 11:1, that the reason either Jesus had to go down to Egypt, because out of Egypt have I called my son, misquoting Hosea chapter 11:1. And you'll see that Matthew does something very similar in Hosea 11:1. As he's going to do here in Micah 5. This is very important. So there is, I mean, it's comical, but it's very dark. And unfortunately, the effect which is understandable that this would have on Europeans, on Christians, would be catastrophic for the Jewish people. It would portray the Jews as people of the devil, as subhuman, as untermenschen, of people who are capable of ultimately wanting to kill Christ. They would fail here in the early parts of Matthew, in the infancy narrative, but they would ultimately succeed in this endeavor to kill the Messiah in the passion narrative later on in the book of Matthew in chapter 27 and so on. So this is very, very dark, my friends. And that's why you have a completely vestigial element to the story. Why did the star have to go to Jerusalem to ask Herod and the Jews where was the Messiah born? What do you need it for? The star could find Jesus' house. Didn't need them. How do I know that? Because they don't tell him what street he's on. They only said he's born in Bethlehem. If that means a star is a magical star. The star really knows exactly the place where the Messiah is born. If that's the case, they never had to stop in Jerusalem. The star could have taken them. Matthew inserts this very disturbing story in order to highlight, to contrast, the sharp contrast between how the Jews treat the Messiah, they want to kill him, and how the Gentiles treat the Messiah. They may be ignorant. That's a theme we'll find over and over again throughout the Gospels. The Goyim, they're not so smart. They don't know. They got to ask. But when they find out the truth, they want to embrace Jesus. Like, I imagine Pontius Pilate was a man who wasn't very well versed in the Bible. His wife certainly would not have been. She may have not been literate. But no, they knew enough to defend Jesus. And the crowds, the hordes of Jews were saying, crucify Jesus. We take his blood upon us and upon our children. In Luke, they're washing their hands. Herod washes their hands. By the way, as we go later and later in the Gospels, meaning chronologically, we'll find more and more Jew hatred. The responsibility for Jesus' crucifixion falls squarely on the head of the Jew, and the responsibility for the crucifixion of Jesus will recede when the Roman responsibility will recede, to the point of John, where literally Pontius Pilate, we are told in John alone, that Pontius Pilate literally will give Jesus over to the Jews to be crucified. That's only found in the book of John. If we go further to apocryphal texts, which were not accepted into the New Testament canon, and thank God they were not, if we go to the Gospel of Peter, we go to the Epistle of Barnabas, and these are second century, they actually are even more anti-Jewish, more anti-Semitic, and I would say that, of course, if these books nearly made it in, and had the Gospel of Peter made it into the canon, which it might have, or the Epistle of Barnabas made it in, Christian-Jewish relations would have been worse, if that was all possible. Now you have a better understanding, holy children of God, of what has happened here and the poison that is falling through. And that now we understand why the star needs to stop off in Jerusalem. There is no reason, if the star was in fact a magical star that knew exactly where Jesus' home was. This is magical.
Yeah, it's important. So it's Matthew that has this part of the narrative. It's Matthew that has the misrepresented texts, 11 such examples, you say, which Luke is not so guilty of. I'll just remind the listeners that the key verse in Luke is Luke chapter 2, verses 4 and 5, and it says, Joseph went up from Galilee, out of the city of Nazareth, into Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house of the lineage of David, to be registered with Mary, his betrothed wife, who was with child. And so it was while they were there that the days were completed for her to be delivered, and she brought forth her firstborn son, so on and so forth. So there's the connection to Bethlehem there. Now, I'm a little bit confused. What are the similarities between Luke and Matthew? Because here in Matthew, do they live in Bethlehem? And here in Luke, they travel from Nazareth to Bethlehem.
I have no doubt in my mind that Christians are more familiar with the infancy narratives, which there are only two as mentioned earlier, than they are with probably any other narrative in the gospel. It's probably the case because Christmas is a very popular holiday where these stories are told over. And I think that many Christians are aware that there are differences between them, but Christians perceive that the Matthew and Luke just simply are two stories of Jesus being born in Bethlehem, and they each complement the other, and essentially it's one big they fuse the stories together, and that's how it's in fact conveyed in church. And it's one big happy story where Jesus does everything.
That's exactly how it's presented. That's a good word to use, fuse. Jason, in the tradition you were brought up in, and your experience of the birth of Jesus and the narrative, did it ever occur to you to isolate each story and look at it and compare them, or was it just one story that sort of melded together from all four Gospels and every year that's the birth narrative that we have? What was it for you?
Yeah, you weren't encouraged to look. You were given this kind of slideshow. First slide star, second slide wise man, third slide Herod, angry. Fourth slide, Jesus born next to a donkey. You never really, the journey of how Jesus got to that stable or that barn was never a mention. And nor was where he went afterwards. Then you get, screenshot Jesus Galilee, screenshot, Nazareth. Mm-hmm.
So it's the abridged or the paraphrased fused together, if you like, and that's generally what we were fed. And it's not something that we ever felt that we should question. But what I would say to listeners is, if you have not done the exercise, first of all, it would be a great help for you to get Let's Get Biblical, Why Doesn't Judaism Accept the Christian Messiah, Volume 1 and 2, an excellent resource, and just isolate each of these Gospels and compare back and forth. Tobia, so many Christian scholars have attempted to bring out a complete story that includes all the details of every Gospel to make them the harmony of the Gospels. How many times have we heard that? The harmony of the Gospels.
Yeah.
It's a very, very difficult thing to do. And in this case, between Luke and Matthew, there's some incredible differences.
In fact, and this is not hyperbole, we know that there are in virtually every story in the Gospels, no two Gospels agree on exactly what happened. You have to line them up side by side. Many people are very aware of the differences in the passion narratives between the four Gospels, which are stark. Some of them, the problems are much more serious than the other. Some of the problems are completely convoluted. Yet, there are no two stories in the entire Christian canon that are more convoluted and are more contradictory than this particular infancy narrative. And it may be what I do, just for a moment, briefly, is help the listener understand how to understand why these two stories are not only, they're not harmony, but what they are is a cacophony of noise. There are only three things that Matthew and Luke agree upon, and that is that Jesus was born to a virgin, and her name was Mary, and he was born in the city of Bethlehem. As we'll see in a moment, it's going to be really important to both of them to create a plot device to get Jesus to be born in Bethlehem. But these two stories are very different. Now you'll ask yourself, how come Matthew didn't just look up the New Testament and look up what it says there and go and not contradict? The answer, obviously, is there was no New Testament to look at. Matthew and Luke couldn't get on the phone and make the stories work together. Let me just explain to the listeners why, to those listening to this broadcast, why the problem. If I ask you, the listener, Joseph and Mary, they were a couple. Yeah? What was their original hometown according to the New Testament? Where did they start off? What was their starting point? Here we have a couple, they came together, they were betrothed. Where was their hometown? When I ask an audience this question, what answer do I usually get? I get Nazareth, Hey, that's what I usually get. People will say Nazareth. But in fact, this is where the departures begin. They're very different. According to Luke, the couple originally started off in Nazareth. Luke's in-sentencing narrative in Stetzler is much more extensive than Matthew. But it's very clear that the family starts off in Nazareth. What happens is, under Caesar Augustus, under Caesar, what happens is there's a worldwide census, and everybody has to return. Everybody in the Roman Empire has to go to the city for where their ancestors came from 1,000 years ago. And given that Joseph was his great-great-grandfather was King David, and King David was born in the city of Bethlehem, the family then is compelled to travel, from the Galilee all the way down to Beis Lechem. We're talking about 80, 90 miles, a long distance. So they had to travel for a few days, at least 4 days, in order to get there. Now, when they come to Bethlehem, they don't have a house. They don't, because their house is up in Nazareth. So they try to find a hotel to stay in, a Holiday, a La Quinta, something. But there's no room at the inn. That's very important. So what are they forced to do? They're forced to stay in a barn. And therefore, Jesus is actually born in a manger, which is like a trough where a horse eats from. So this is the story of Luke. What happens then in the book of Luke is that finally, Jesus is born, and there are shepherds who come to worship him, and so on and so forth. And then the family then goes to Jerusalem, and in Jerusalem, Mary brings the appropriate sacrifices of the woman who's just given birth, and then 33 days later, they return to Nazareth. That's where Jesus is raised in Nazareth, and in fact, later on, Jesus as a child, it's the only place in the New Testament we're told anything about what Jesus was like when he was a kid, where we have the story of him, the family going to Jerusalem, visit Jerusalem again. They happen to forget their kid behind. They come back, and Jesus is there in the temple having conversations with bright people who are impressed with Jesus' intelligence. That is the story in the book. So Luke starts off in Nazareth. They come down to Bethlehem. They both want, this is the overarching point, Matthew and Luke need to have Jesus born in Bethlehem. So Luke has them start off in Nazareth, go down to Bethlehem, and then basically a month later, they go back to Jerusalem, where at the temple sacrifices are offered, and then they go to Nazareth, and that's where Jesus spends
his life. There's no trip to there's no slaughtering of the innocents. There's no going to going to Egypt, even though an angel told them to go to Egypt, and then out of Egypt you've got to fulfill that prophecy, out of Egypt I call my son, and yet we don't have that, because what we have in Luke chapter 2 verse 39, so they when they had performed all these things according to the law of the Lord, they returned to Galilee, to their own city, Nazareth, and the child grew up and became strong, and so on and so forth.
Matthew, it's not just, this is an important point here, it's not just that Luke doesn't have that part in it. So people say, it's just not there, but it happened, it's just Luke doesn't mention it. It just doesn't work. They either went down to Egypt, and they were down there for a long time until Herod the Great was dead, and we'll get to that in a moment, or they went up to Nazareth. So it's not that each, this is how Christians perceive, that each are just supplying information that's not in the other. This is a complete cacophony. These two stories are completely dissident. They're trying to accomplish the same thing, and Matthew, of course, has this completely different. Matthew has the family, the couple, Joseph and Mary, are from Bethlehem. That's their home. There is, therefore, no barn, no hotel, no inn in Matthew's nativity story in chapter 2. Why? Because if you came from Bethlehem, if your home was in Bethlehem, would you stay at a Holiday Inn down the street? Of course not. Would you sleep in a barn if you can sleep, you can give birth? Would you give birth in a barn where you can give birth in your own house? There is no barn, and there is no manger, and none of these things in the book of Matthew. Instead, what happens is that Jesus is born, the men come down. Then Joseph is informed. Joseph is informed that, in fact, Herod is seeking to kill the child. This is the very end of Matthew chapter 2. They do not go to Nazareth, as we mentioned earlier. On the contrary, they have to get out to escape the wrath of Herod, and therefore they will go down to Egypt and remain there until the death of Herod. And then, of course, Matthew 2:23 will say, you know, tell us whatever reason. But they'll go down there, and the key point is this, that an angel then comes to Joseph, because Joseph naturally wants to go back to Bethlehem. The coast is clear. Now there's no reason for them to remain in Egypt, in some place that's outside of the jurisdiction of Herod the Great, who was trying to kill him. By the way, there was no what's called the slaying of the innocents. I mean, no historian, if Herod went and killed out every child in Bethlehem, someone would have mentioned it. It's not mentioned, it never happened. This, of course, is fiction. But setting that aside for a moment, what happens then is the angel informs Joseph that Herod is dead, but there's a new problem, and that is Herod has a son, and his son, in this particular son, his name is Herod Archelaus, who was, if you think Herod the Great was nuts, Herod Archelaus, his son, was a complete psycho. And therefore, the angel informs Joseph, you can't go back to your home in Bethlehem. Instead, you can't go back to Judea, because that's where Herod Archelaus ruled. That's the area that was given to him after the death of Herod. Instead, you have to go up to the Galilee. That would have been outside the jurisdiction of Herod Archelaus. And therefore, the family now has to go to a new place, to Nazareth. And in Nazareth, they're safe from this despot, who, incidentally, Herod Archelaus is such a psycho that the Romans remove him in 6 CE because he was even too crazy, too anti-Semitic, too anti-Jewish for the Romans. So he's taken away, and Quirinus, the governor of Syria, takes over. One other point should be made here, and this, I think, is very... People are waking up to this. Wait, according to Matthew, Jesus was alive when Herod the Great was alive. They were contemporaries. And it's not that Jesus was born a day before Herod the Great died, and we know that's 4 BCE. The reason we know that is because the way Matthew presents this is that the soldiers are told to kill any child who's 2 years old and younger. The question is, why such a variance? Everyone can tell the difference between a two-year-old and a newborn. So the answer is that Matthew's story entails Jesus being a little toddler when this is occurring, and therefore they have to kill all the children, including toddlers, in the book of Matthew. So now, Herod the Great, just so you understand this part of the Herodian dynasty. So Herod the Great dies in 4 BCE. His we'll call it kingdom. He was a proxy of the Romans, but basically there was a division of power after his death. Herod Archelaus is given control over Judea. His reign begins in 4 BCE when Herod the Great dies, and in 6 CE, as I mentioned a moment ago, he is removed because of a whole series of events, but culminates in a massacre on Passover. I'm not going to go into it now. But the key is, what happens then is Judea is then taken away from the Herodian dynasty, and instead the governor of Syria, his name is Quirinus, he's controlling Syria, he's given, the Romans then say, hey, I need you to take care of Judea as well. So Judea now falls under the jurisdiction of the governor of Syria. So the governor of Syria, his rule now expands vastly. Now, this is very critical because we're told in the book of Luke that when Quirinus, who did a census for the purpose of taxation, we know when that took place. This takes place in the year 6 CE. There's no one moving all over the Roman Empire, and it was very isolated. But the key point is this. Jesus could not, either Matthew is correct that Jesus was born before the death of Herod, let's say 4, 6 BCE. Okay, I always found it funny because this would mean basically that according to Matthew, Jesus was born 6 years before Christ. But that's a different point. But the key is Matthew has Jesus born in, let's say, about the year 6 BCE. And according to Luke, and these two cannot be the same because you understand that one follows the other. Jesus was born during the time when Quirinus, the governor of Syria, governed this period, governed the area of Judea, and then had a census. Well, yet for the purpose of taxation. Well, those two could not be the same. Luke and Matthew could both they couldn't possibly have happened. So all they have in common is Jesus was born to a virgin named Mary in the city of Bethlehem. Their stories, of course, are there's no harmony here. There's cacophony. There's no music over here. There's just a lot of noise. Two different plot devices, and the aim of both of them, the overarching aim, is to get someone who was born in Nazareth, who I believe Jesus would have been born in Bethlehem. And this, incidentally, people, one other point, a footnote here, if I may. People ask me, do you think Jesus really existed? Was he a real person? And it's a question I get, probably quite one of the most popular questions I'm asked. Maybe you're asked this as well. This is one of the things that we can't say for sure because there was no contemporaneous historian who mentions it. But this, and along with a few other stories, is what convinces me that there probably was an itinerant preacher who from Nazareth, because why would Nazareth be mentioned? That means no one ever heard of Nazareth. It was a one-horse town in the middle of the northern Galilee, mentioned by no one. No, Josephus, Talmud, Tanakh, it's mentioned nowhere. That means like this, if Jesus literally never existed, and there are some people and scholars who say he never existed, none of this, these somersaults, these contrivances would be necessary. Because obviously Matthew and Luke knew that Jesus was really born in Nazareth. They wanted to change that datum and have him born in Bethlehem, the city of David. They each can create these extremely elaborate stories to make that happen. There happen to be opposite stories. But the point is this, and this is again my opinion, is if there was no such person ever in history, never existed, none of this would have been necessary. They would have just both said that he was born in Bethlehem, and no, why mention Nazareth? Why have the stories? So interestingly, it is the fiction in the Christian Bible, it is the lies in the Gospels that tell me that there was probably a real person from Nazareth who everyone is trying to get to be born in Bethlehem. And that's just a side point here.
That's fascinating. Jason, what's going through your mind?
Just a couple of things. I actually spent some time on this a while ago looking at historical evidence for this census. And it's kind of interesting because Herod the Great dies in 4 BCE and because the census came at between 6 and 7 CE, that means that Herod the Great, if he gave that command, did it from beyond the grave, which is kind of interesting. Also, no Roman census is on record at that time outside of the gospel tradition that included everybody. Yeah.
Jason, you're from Ireland. You're in Australia. Let's say there was a census. I mean, governments do have to tax their people and therefore have to know who lives where. So there was a census. And in fact, it was this limited census that people speculate that began the zealot movement. We're not going to go there, but this is going to create a problem because censuses and taxation often get people in trouble. But let's say you were told that, let's say Australia was said that every person in Australia had to return back to where their ancestors lived 1,000 years ago. Jono, where would you go? Jason, where would you go? The answer is it's ridiculous. What would be the purpose of people having to travel back? How would they know where their ancestors lived 1,000 years ago? What would be the purpose in collecting taxes? The only people who moved around during any census for taxation were the tax collectors and the census takers, not the people who were being counted and who would have to pay the census. This is very, would have to pay the taxes.
That's such a good point that you made, because I suppose if that was the case, that you had to go back to your town of origin for the point of taxation, and all of a sudden you've got people moving all over the place, that what a logistical nightmare. And I've never really given that consideration either.
So Josephus records that between 6 and 7 CE, after Herod Achillaus, I think you pronounce it, there was a census that went out, but that's only Josephus. And within a Roman census, only Roman people were recorded. They wouldn't have recorded every itinerant that was walking around, or a Jew certainly wouldn't have been included. And there's no Roman census that included, and that ever asked Jews to return to their ancestral homes, or even the Jewish people, or even Roman people. So that bit there is really kind of, and because it's only Josephus, and because we kind of know where Josephus was getting his money, it's a bit, I don't know, I can't put my faith in it.
Okay, no, fair enough. I was just going to say the other key verse here, as you mentioned, Tobia, is John chapter 7, verse 41. And well, I'll start from verse 40. It says, "Therefore many from the crowd, when they heard this saying, said, "Truly, this is the prophet." Others said, "This is the Christ." But some said, "Will the Christ come out of Galilee? Has not the scripture said that the Christ will come from the seed of David and from the town of Bethlehem where David was?" And so there was a division among the people, and so on and so forth. And so, you know, the questions, it doesn't, it, and it doesn't make any reference
unresolved.
To...
The author
unresolved.
Of John,
it's unresolved.
The author of John is not, this is very important. This is a slap in the face to what was going around. Because obviously John, whoever wrote the book of John, we don't know, but whoever wrote the book of John, this is very late, is aware of this, and John doesn't like it at all. That's why John is not, we just, I think I've said this in a show before, John, of course, mentions nothing about the birth of Jesus, because the birth of Jesus in the city he's born is unimportant. It's not, wait, I'm going to change, I retract that. It's not unimportant. It's antithetical to what John is trying to convey. John begins with a prologue. It's called Higher Christology. It's the first 18 verses of John, John 1 through 18. In verse 17, we find out that the Word that became flesh is Jesus. It's very obvious what's happening there. So what John is trying to do is get the reader away from the birth and stop focusing on Jesus' mother. And it's not important he was born of a virgin, because his birth is not where he becomes son. He was son in the distance past, in some early past, and that this incidentally becomes a big argument on Christians, exactly what the prologue means. But the one thing no one disagrees with, one point that no one disagrees with, is that John does not want to deal with this. So this is a slap in the face, and that is, this is not important when he was, where he was born. Jesus was God's son before creation. He was God's son in the eternal past. This is why there's no mention whatsoever of a baptism. Doesn't want a baptism in John. There's no mention of Mary, of Jesus' mother Mary, meaning her name is not mentioned. And when she is introduced at the miracle in Cana, at the miracle in Cana where Jesus, we are told, is, turns water into wine, Jesus speaks to his mother derisively. So that's what's happening in John 7. John leaves it open. He could have said, or the author could have then straightened the record out, he was born in Bethlehem. No, John leaves this out because of us. What is it? Why doesn't, what is that put in there with no answer, with no response? The reason no response is, you idiot, stop talking about Bethlehem. Jesus is from the eternal past, the prologue. Therefore, his birth is unimportant. Mother, what do I have to, woman, what do I, he, Jesus doesn't even call his mother. Mother, it's very interesting. In the miracle in Cana at the wedding,
was a woman.
He says woman. He doesn't say mother. What kind of way
to talk? What do I have to do with you, woman?
Exactly. Yeah. You're seeing how the theology dictates the story rather than the other way around. Exactly.
And so that's the only thing that we have in John. So we've done Matthew, Luke, John, and Mark. There's nothing, right? There's no, and this is the, Mark is the first gospel that was penned, but we really don't have any sort of detail, do we?
We have zero. Mark is early. So Mark has been the least embellished of all the gospels.
Punishments come later.
Yeah,
now,
of course.
Now, the verse in question, as I mentioned earlier on, is Micah chapter 5, and it's the first couple of verses. Can you, my friend, would you put this into its context and tell us what's going on here? What is it? What is it actually saying? What is the significance of these verses?
Well, it depends where you read the verse. This is number. I say this with a heavy heart and with deep love in my soul for people who I didn't used to care about as a child, that's non-Jews and Christians, who Nebuch, tragically, when their knowledge of Micah 5, and just so there isn't a confusion, in a Jewish Bible, this passage appears as Micah 5:1. In a Christian Bible, this same passage appears in Micah 5:2, just so there isn't that confusion. But what's happening in Matthew chapter 2, verse 6, is there's a quote. And the quote is, we are told, the rabbis, the priests, are informing these wise men that in fact Herod, that the Messiah is to be born in Bethlehem, because again, that's the city of David, that's the place where David comes from. Now, if we read the passage in Matthew, there are problems with Matthew's translation of the passage, but I don't want to overload the listeners to get into other problems there, because they're relatively unimportant compared to the massive one. If you read the passage as it appears in the book of Matthew, meaning go looking at Matthew 2:6, which most Christians do, rather than going back to the original, it really does look like there's a prophecy in Micah. And to give you some time frame, Micah lived roughly 700 years before the Christian era. He was a contemporary of Isaiah, for example. So if we look at Matthew, we'd see there, but you, Bethlehem, land of Judea, are in no wise least, you're not least among the princes of Judah. It's in reverse. It really does say you should have been least. But again, let's ignore that, because that's not the big deal. If you ask me why later, I'll tell you why he changed that. Because out of you will come a governor, or come a ruler. Now, that's very clear. And then it says, who shall shepherd my people Israel? This, my friends, if you read this in Matthew 2:6, it very clearly looks like that Micah is telling us something very important about the Messiah's birth, and that is, because there is no other way reasonably to read this passage as it appears in Matthew, and that is that the verse is saying, giving us something a little bit more about the Messiah, which Micah is referring to the Messiah in chapter 5, just so you know, that it does very clearly look like the Messiah is going to be born in Bethlehem. So it's very simple. Now, if, however, my friends, you go back to the Sefer Micha, the book of Micah, you'll notice something very interesting. If you read almost all the verse in Micah 5:1, whether you read it in Hebrew or you read it in any translation, it too looks like the Messiah is supposed to be born in Bethlehem, except for section B, the modifier. Watch
the modifier. So would you like me to read it?
Yeah, that means read Micah 5:1, and we're going to compare this to Matthew 2:6, and you're going to see what was done to our Bible. Go ahead.
And this is Micah 5:2 in a Christian translation. I'm reading from the New King James, and it says, "But you, Bethlehem, Ephratah, though you are little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth to me, the one, capital O, to be ruler, capital R, in Israel, the one to be ruler in Israel, who's going forth are from of old, from everlasting."
Right. Now, it happens to be that the text there is Umoitsoisav Mikedemi Mei Olam, which means from ancient time, from antiquity, from ancient times, origins from old, from ancient times. Mei Olam means from ancient times. Now, I will say to you this, that although that sounds, I think that's the New King James that you're reading, I don't want to disparage every Christian Bible. Many, like the Revised Standard Version, even the NIV, which usually is the villain in translations, correctly translates the passage of Micah 5, of course it'll appear as 5:2, it will say me, mei olam, of course, is from ancient times, and that's how the NIV read the New English Bible. Most of them do. The King James is going to go from antiquity. We know from everlasting, because they want to make it look like it comes from ancient. But what the text says is, whose origins are from old, from ancient times. So now let's now separate this passage into two segments, and you'll see what's happened here. This is going to be rather startling, I think, to many people. Let's separate this passage in Micah into two parts. Part A says, "And you, Bethlehem Ephratah, you should have been the least of the clans of Judah. However, from you will emerge me a ruler over Israel." Stop. That's section one. Does that sound like the Messiah, because that's who it's speaking about, is supposed to be born in Bethlehem? And the answer is, you bet it does. Mm-hmm. However, there's the modifier. And the modifier are the last four words. Umoitsoisav, and it's like Hamotzi Lechem Min Ha'aretz, who brings forth his source, the antecedent. Where does this, what is the connection between the Messiah and Bethlehem? Where's the connection? So this last part, the ending of Micah 5:1 or 5:2, is critical. It says Umoitsoisav, and where is the connection? Where does it go forth that the Messiah comes from Bethlehem? It's not from when he's born. No, it's Mikedem, from his origins from old, mimei olam, from ancient days. That's what's critical. So the end of the passage tells us this is the connection between the Mashiach and Bethlehem. What does it mean? It's obvious what it means, and that is, it's not that the Messiah is supposed to be born in Bethlehem, but rather it's from the connection that the Messiah will have with Bethlehem is not him in the present, but it's from ancient times, of course, and that's King David. King David was, in fact, born in Bethlehem, as we see in 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 58. As you can well imagine, this modifier at the end of the passage of Micah is a major problem. This cannot be left intact. It can't. As far as Matthew is concerned, this has to be stripped. It has to be surgically eliminated. Now, I say to the listeners, take a deep breath, because if you go to people read this their whole life and never notice this. You'll notice that what does Matthew do? He's not an idiot. So if you go back to Matthew chapter 2, verse 6, you'll see there that what he did. At the end of Matthew 2:6, we have rulers, Judah, for out of you will come a ruler. And how does Matthew 2:6 end? Does it say there that his origin is from old, from ancient days, which would tell us it's not the Messiah? No, he has to surgically remove it. It has to be stripped. What does he do? He interpolates, he inserts and said, who will be a shepherd over my people? It doesn't say that in Micah 5. How do you change my Bible? Who stuck these words in there? You think this is an accident? Incidentally, you'd be saying, Matthew's quoting Septuagint, Septuagint. No, this was very carefully done. This was very well thought out. And Matthew realized that he had to remove that modifier at the end of the passage of Micah, insert another very nebulous little shepherd over my people Israel, and suddenly you have a brand new verse, and this brand new verse sounds like Jesus is supposed to be born in Bethlehem, and bingo, you've now stripped the Bible, you've altered the Jewish scriptures in order to make it appear Christological.
Isn't that, and as you say, this is characteristic of Matthew, but just to reiterate, it says, yet in Micah, it says, yet out of you shall come forth to me the one to be ruler in Israel. In Matthew, it says, out of you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people in Israel. And it stops there, but in Micah, it continues, who's going forth from ancient days. Jason, what's going through your mind?
Well, I'm looking at this and I'm kind of, you know, the tradition I was brought up in, instantly my brain would click in when I looked at Micah at the from ancient times thing, and we'd start equating that to Jesus. No, he was born before this. So does whose origins from of old, from ancient times, does that mean before creation, or can we assert ancient times as just a previous history of the people?
Well, I'm glad. No, before you say anything, Tovia, it's just that you pointed out, and as I've said often on the program before, the New King James is highly Christological in the way that it translates and the way that it plays with the text, with the use of capitals and the choice of cherry picking of words. And in the study notes of this particular verse, it highlights, you know, going forth, this particular moderator, as you say, the birth of this Savior King would be unlike the birth of any other because he was pre-existent. He is from everlasting. They have in bold there, from everlasting. But as you say, it's not exactly what it says. What it says is of ancient days.
Yeah, this is the language of the prophets. In fact, we don't have to even leave the book of Micah. We can remain there and go to Micah chapter 7, verse 14. Well, Micah is again recalling the ancient days. And if you look at Micah chapter 7, verse 14 in the King James Bible, we have the same words, kimei olam, which means like in ancient days. And if you look it up in Micah 7:14,
this is what I've got.
Yes.
Let me read it. It says, shepherd your flock with your staff, the flock of your heritage who dwell solitarily in a woodland in the midst of Carmel. Let them feed in Bashan and Gilead as in days of old.
Exactly. Now look at the Hebrew. The Hebrew is the same. Kimei olam. like days of old. I mean, they can go to the Book of Malachi. We talked about Malachi chapter 3. You know, it's very important. We're talking about Malachi in chapter 3 is saying that how things will be restored and the wrong, the crooked places will be made straight and so on and so forth. An idea we see in the Book of Isaiah. And what does it say there in Malachi chapter 3 verse 4? Then the offerings of Orvel, Hashem, Amin Chesedah, then the very famous saying in our prayers, then the offering of Judah and Jerusalem will be pleasant unto the Lord as Kimei Olam, as in days of old, which always means as in the former times, as things were. So the word Kimei Olam is always not just talking about a time period in the past. It's recalling the old times, the good old times. I'm using that refrain. Meaning that's Kimei Olam means things are going to come back just like the good old days. We find it in Isaiah 63, and we find it in Amos chapter 9:11 that the tabernacle will be raised up, and it'll be what it'll be like in the days of old, Kimei Olam. And in fact, there's not a single place in the entire Jewish scriptures where the word Mimei Olam or Kimei Olam is ever translated as everlasting, except here in Micah chapter 5:2. The reason why? Why does it mean one thing in every other place it appears, but only here in this one place it means everlasting? The answer is it's theological. This is not a translation. What the King James is doing is participating our full cohorts in this crime that whoever wrote the Book of Matthew committed, and therefore trying to say, aha, this must be referring to Jesus not just born in Bethlehem and that's where his sonship begins. No, it's in fact goes back to the everlasting time, and that's what Jesus is. Jesus is God manifested in the flesh. This is a terrible crime that's happened here.
If Matthew had collaborated with John somehow and they worked together, Matthew might have quoted to the end of the verse and used that, but of course that's not what it said to him, so he cut it short.
Right, exactly. Now, one of the interesting things is in some cases we have, when the Christian translates the Jewish Bible, actually take the bleach. You know how you remove fingerprints is you use bleach, right? And you wash down the fingerprints. People who commit crimes wash the fingerprints off before they leave so the police won't be able to identify who they are. So that's done often. The Christian Bible will, for instance, the King James, will translate, behold, a virgin shall conceive in Isaiah 7:14, so it conforms to Matthew chapter 1, verse 23. In this case, the Christian Bibles do not put in the words, and he will be a shepherd over Israel. They leave that in, but in so therefore you could see that even in your own Christian Bible, but they will change the word Mei Olam, because Mei Olam has the word Olam in there. Olam means eternity, but if it has days, then it's not eternity. So Mei Olam, Ki Mei Olam, means from ancient times. So we have the fingerprints intact. We don't have the bleaching down that we will find in, let's say, Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14.
Fascinating stuff. Oh, my goodness. We're going to have to wrap this up because we're running out of time. Is there any other detail that we need to put into this discussion, or shall we wrap it up?
Well, I think what's important is this hopefully can help the listener. People say, oh, my. I'm just imagining that people are wondering, well, I can't. How will I ever figure this out? My Hebrew's not so good. I all my life I was a Christian. I never even saw this in my life. What I recommend you do is just not use that kind of vertical reading, and which people typically do. They read Matthew and then they read Luke, or they read Havdil, they read Isaiah, and then they read. Don't do that. What you do is, don't be afraid. If truth is on your side, when God is by your side, no one can make you afraid. Just look it up for yourself and read the context. And in fact, later on in Micah chapter 5, it tells us that this ruler is going to be the one who's going to destroy the enemies of God, which Jesus failed to do. So in fact, if Micah 5:2 is talking about the Messiah, it can't be Jesus, because as it turns out, the end of the text says he's going to do things which Jesus did not do. He didn't crush the enemies of the Jewish people. So look it up for yourself. Don't be afraid. It's all there.
Jason, any final thoughts, my friend?
Just for the readers to remember that if they're relying on their Bible and they haven't had a look at the text, there may be a different translation, or they've had a thump at the Hebrew, they don't have a clue what they're reading. They're reading a translation from a different language, a And unless they've checked that translation, they're taking it completely on faith that it means what it means. So I'd really encourage people. There's a whole load of good stuff online, Bible CC, Bible Hub, that will show you the Hebrew words that are underneath the English text. And, you know, it's daunting, but you can do it. So go and check it out.
And let me add to that as well, that I know we've had a lot of detail in this discussion. There's a lot of things for people to take in. It is in so much more detail in the book. Oh, my goodness. It really, really is, Toby. You've really gone into significant detail on this particular topic, and people can find that in the Volume 1 of Let's Get Biblical, Why Doesn't Judaism Accept the Christian Messiah? It's a two-volume series. You can get it at outreachjudaism.org. That's outreachjudaism.org. I highly, highly recommend that you do that. It'd make a good Christmas gift, wouldn't it? I think that it is an idea. Yeah. So now that we've burst some bubbles, but I tell you what, you know, you've got some months to get over it. Okay, so don't be angry at us. You've got some months to do the homework. And it's all going to be okay, right, Tobia?
Yeah, that's good. So, yeah, it is in Volume 1. Enjoy it. Look it up. And one thing for sure, when you have the truth, when you have the MS, you don't have to be afraid. Just look it up for yourself. That's all.
So true.
It's enough following men. Don't follow me either. That's why I always say, let's look it up together. It's in your Bible. I don't say follow Tobia. Don't follow me. Maybe Jason a little bit, but don't follow. Follow, just look it up for yourself. There was nothing I quoted that you can't look up for yourself. It's all there. All I've done is it's I just shine light and say, give a look. It's over there. Do it for yourself. You have the MS on your side. You have nothing to fear.
Thank you, Jason of spiritualbabies.net, for coming back on. Thank you so much, Rabbi Tobias Singer of outreachjudaism.org. Get the books, people. And in the meantime, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.